No kidding?
Yeah, I bet you.
This paper box, pass this down.
Where?
Yeah. Just put it here on the table. And maybe... Okay, let's see, we're off to here in Sanhedrin. We got a doozy of a sugya today about Roy Bokar and... So we're on Chof Heyam at Bays. And we gave an introduction yesterday to the new sugya, which is on the bottom of the Amud, and you'll see it on the second of the wide lines. Tana. We learned it a Braisa. Od Hosifu Alehem. The Braisa wants to add other categories of Psule Edus that are rabbinically disqualified because of historical developments, meaning that people became more, shall we say, intense about misbehaviors. It became more widespread. Okay, so what are the cases that were added? Number one is Haroim. These are shepherds. Number two is Gaboim. And these are tax collectors. And Muhsim are also tax collectors. It's not so crystal clear what the difference is between Gaboim and Muhsim. Some say that the Gaboim was specifically delegated to collect taxes from the Jewish population, whereas Muhsin were general tax collectors. Others say that that Gaboim were collecting taxes from real estate. You had a real estate tax. Muhsin were collecting other taxes, like for people who traveled on the roads. They would have to pay a fee for using the road. Some say that the difference between Gaboim and Muhsim is that the Gaboim received a fee for their service. I think it's getting dry over here, but yeah, okay, we'll see.
Try to dry it off.
Okay. And they didn't pocket any of the money. They were just conduits to collect the taxes and bring it to the government, whereas Muhsin would pay the government a certain fee in order to have the rights to collect the taxes and pocket the taxes, which would mean that Muhsin are much closer to theft. In other words, if they're actually pocketing the taxes that they're collecting, you can imagine that they might want to overcharge people and pocket that money. And all this is something that the Chachamim, with the passage of time, enacted to expand the categories of people who are possible. Now, I just want to quote a Beis Yosef here in Choshen Mishpat to explain the difference between Gaboim and Muhsim. He claims that Gaboim, Mekablim Schar Katsuv, they have a set salary that they get for collecting the taxes from the members of the city. But the Moches is someone who buys the rights, he gets the license. It's like in taxis, you buy a medallion, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so they would buy the medallion to collect taxes, when those taxes they would pocket themselves. That's the Beis Yosef. Now, a little bit later than the Beis Yosef, who was 500 years ago, was the Sma, the Sefer Mir Seinayim. He says that the Gabai collects the taxes based on per capita or per house. Those are two ways that they collect. There's some taxes that are collected per head and others per bias. You know, every house, no matter how many people lived in the house, would have to pay a certain X amount of real estate tax. V'davar zehu yadua umafursam. He says that it was absolutely clear, based on the ordinances and the decrees of the government, exactly how much you would have to pay. So you knew how many heads there were, unless there were people hiding, as we'll soon see later on. and how many houses there were. So that's a Dover Yadua Umafursa. In other words, he couldn't collect more than the amount of money that everybody knew was collectible. But a moches is much more complicated, much more subtle. According to the Sma, the moches is someone who taxes profits. Let's say if you're in the retail wholesale business, so you have merchandise that's sold and you made a profit on it. Or, for example, moches would collect taxes according to the financial income of a person. So the richer people would be taxed a higher tax and the poor people less. In such a case, it's eina yadua. It's not absolutely clear to everyone how much schor yesh, how much is this guy worth, or how much profits he had in any particular year. And therefore the moches, to a large extent, has the leeway, he has the discrepancy to decide how much tax he should be charged. And it's not actually, you know, legally calculated. Today everything is in computers, you know, exactly what percentage has to be taxed. But in those days, a lot was left to the discretion of the moches, the tax collector. So now the Gemara is going to analyze these three categories one by one, starting with Roim. And the Gemara is going to try always to be sensitive to the historical change, meaning initially the Torah recognized a roeh, a shepherd, as a valid witness. There was nothing to disqualify him. And at some point in history, because of some misbehavior, you know, some phenomenon of widespread misbehavior, there was a decision on the part of the Chachamim that Roim don't have credibility and they should be disqualified for testimony. Now, the Chachamim must have woken up one day, so to speak, I don't mean that literally, but and decided that they want to disqualify the shepherds. What happened? Initially, they didn't disqualify the shepherds. What happened that at some point in time they decided we're going to apostle the shepherds? Meikara, the Gemara says, initially, which is, goes back to the time of the Mishnah, because the Brisa is written a little bit later than the Mishnah, is Savur, meaning the Chachamim were of the opinion that we should not disqualify the Roim. Why? Because even though occasionally the animals under the tutelage, under the supervision of the shepherd, would sometimes wander into other people's fields and eat from those fields, which is certainly illegal, but nevertheless it was not done bekavana. It wasn't that the shepherds would deliberately take their flocks into the fields of other people in order to steal their produce. But it cried be almahu, but rather it was mikra. Mikra means it was just a coincidence, and sometimes, unbeknown to the roeh, the animals strayed a little bit off the path, they crossed the boundaries, and they ate from other people's produce. In that case, the roeh doesn't lose his credibility in a court of law because he's not considered a gazlan. But what happened in a later period of time, a little bit after the Mishnah, came under Chazu, the Chacham began to see, they became aware, de kamachavne, that this was a deliberate act on the part of the roeh. They would take advantage of the fact that no one was around, and they would deliberately shadu means to send, lechatchila, from the get-go, they would send their flock into the sados, into the fields of others. And that's outright gzela. It's then gozu be'rabbanon, and the rabbanon made a gzera, and they enacted that these roim are considered disqualified. Meaning a stam roeh, your run-of-the-mill roeh from that period of time was so guilty, it was such rampant misbehavior that we don't trust the roeh. Now, what do you derive from the fact that the Brisa says Hosifu? Are we dealing with a Psul Doraisa, my friends, or a Psul Durabanan? Durabanan. Hosifu means Durabanan added it. Now, if the Roeh was guilty of deliberately shepherding his animals into the fields of others to eat from their fields, then the obvious question to be asked is, why is that a Psul Durabanan? I don't need Durabanan to come along and enact such a Psul. That should be a psul doraisa. That's a maisik zela when you take your animals into someone else's field in order to eat the produce from someone else's field. Now, before we get into the answer that's offered here by the Tosfos HaRosh and other Rishonim, let's just mention the famous sheet of the Rif. The Rif says that not every shepherd, you know, you walk away from this Gemara without the Rif, and you get the impression that every single shepherd is considered Becheskas Gazlan, because every shepherd would take his animals and his flock into someone else's field. Says the Rif, that's far, far from true. What we're talking about is not roe in the classic sense of a shepherd. Like, for example, I don't know if you've ever seen here on the street, you'll see people walking 5 dogs or 10 dogs, right? A shepherd, in the classic sense, is like that person who walks everybody's dog. He gets paid he gets a fee for that. And a shepherd gets a fee for the owners of these animals. It could be one owner, it could be many owners. In such a case, the roa is kosher liedus. The only case that the Gemara has in mind, where by virtue of rabbinic enactment they disqualified a roa, that's only a roa who is the proud owner of these animals. And in order to explain this distinction between a roa who's shepherding other people's animals and a roa who's shepherding his own animals, the Rif invokes a principle called Ein Adam Chote Velo Lo. That a person doesn't sin if he doesn't benefit from the sin. Meaning, you're going to pay me for my service as a shepherd. You're not paying me because I'm taking your animals into someone else's field illegally stealing. You're paying me to make sure that the animal, you know, I do the best job that I can to make sure the animal is fed. But I don't have to go overboard, you know, to steal from other people's fields in order to be a good roeh and deserve my payment and collect my fee. So that's called Ein Adam Chote Velo Lo. A person doesn't sin if he doesn't get any benefit from it. But if a person is shepherding his own animals, then obviously he gains by stealing. That's point number one. Point number two is the Tosfos HaRosh. The Tosfos HaRosh asks, how could it be that in this particular case, it was the Rabbanan who passed the Gazlan, meaning the Roeh who took his animals into someone else's fields, when the Torah itself passes a Gazlan, that's a Doraisa Psul, I don't need the Rabbanan to do so. Not only that, he asks another question. The Mishnah itself says, if you recall, the first Mishnah in this Perek, that Neman Olai Shlosha Roi Bakar, that if one of the two litigants agrees to the request of the other litigant that the three judges that will preside on their court are Roi Bakar, their shepherds, then by virtue of the commitment of both litigants, you know, the agreement of both, these three shepherds are authorized to adjudicate the case. Obviously, the only reason why these roe bakar are kosher is because Neman Olai, because the both Reuven and Shimon, the two litigants, agreed to accept the judgment of these roe bakar. In and of themselves, the roe bakar would be pasul. So why does this brisa have to add a psul that's already written in the Mishnah? Does anybody here follow the question? The Mishnah says that if two litigants agree to accept upon themselves the decision of a court when the judges that make up that court are disqualified, but they accepted it upon themselves as a mutual agreement, then it's binding. Again, with all the conditions, Rabbi Meir, Chachamim, and so forth and so on, is the Chazor, is the not. What does that imply? If they accepted upon themselves Roe Bakar, what's the implication, Rabosai? By mathematical deduction?
They're possible.
That they're possible. Otherwise, I don't need this whole discussion about Neman Olai, that the two litigants agreed to accept upon themselves the judgment of these Roe Bakar. So what is this price adding that by telling us that the Chachamim added a new category here called Roe Bakar? It's already written in the Mishnah. The price didn't have to tell me this. So the Tosfos HaRosh says...
How's it written in the Mishnah? I heard it.
The Mishnah says that if the two litigants agree to accept upon themselves the decision of herders, of shepherds, then it's valid. Implying that if they hadn't agreed, these shepherds would be completely disqualified. So why did the Rice have to come on and see, you know, Discover America and tell me that shepherds are disqualified. It says in the Mishnah already that shepherds are disqualified. What do you say?
Would it be because things changed after the Mishnah that all of a sudden they discovered those guys were doing what they shouldn't?
But keep in mind, Bob, that things changed legreus, so they got it worse. If the Mishnah already tells us by implication that the Roi Bak are apostle, I don't need the Bryson to tell me that Roi Bak are apostle. It only gets worse. It never gets better, unfortunately. You know, that's human nature. So the Tosa Rush wants to differentiate here between Din and Eidus, between judgment and testimony. The subject of our Brisa is testimony. Who can qualify to testify in a court of law? The subject of the Mishnah is judgment. And right now, at this point, the Gemara understands that the Mishnah is limited to the discussion about judgment. And Enoch Inami, no doubt about it, the Mishnah assumes that Roi Bakar, the shepherds, are excluded from Din. Why are they excluded from Din?
No.
Again, we don't know that they're postulates. That's going to come later on in history with the Brisa. Exactly. They're not Bekiyim B'Din. Basically, we assume that they are ignorant of the law. And the Torah, with regard to judgment, requires some basic knowledge of the law. We're not disqualifying these Roi Bakar because of the sin of Geza. That's going to come much later on. But rather because of their ignorance. That would not prove anything about their status as witnesses. So it's very interesting. I mean, to me, this is a dover pashut that witnesses don't have to be scholars. You know, we're not going to test a person before he testifies to see if he can get smicha. You know, that's irrelevant. But to be a judge, even if you're not a mumche, you're a hedgehog, but you have to have some basic experience with the law. Otherwise, your judgment is completely unacceptable. Okay, now, as far as the other question is concerned, why aren't Roi Bakar Pasul de Oraisa? Okay.
Pasul de Oraisa
for Gezel. No, it's again, the Gemara is assuming now that they take their own flock and deliberately graze them in the fields of others. Why is that called de Rabbanon? So there are a number of answers to this question I wanted to share with you. One answer is Enoch Inami. It's true, a Roi Bakar is posel d'oraisa. But how do you know that he does this? How do you know that this Roi, Mr. Roi, we'll call him Joe the Roi, how do you know he's guilty of shepherding his animals in somebody else's field? The answer is that Chazal realized that this was becoming rampant behavior, became like anarchy here. People were just simply violating the law. They weren't concerned about Gezel, and this is what the shepherds were doing. It became almost a professional, part of the professional trade of being a roi. On a d'oraisa level, you can't posel someone. You don't know for a fact that he was guilty. If you have two witnesses that testify against him that he stole, that's one thing. That's a psul d'oraisa. He's excluded from testimony on a d'oraisa basis because of a gzela. But we don't have any witnesses to testify that this Joe Shepherd has actually violated gzela. We assume so because we changed the chazakas, meaning the assumption before the rabbanim made this enactment was that a person is innocent until proven guilty. Now we're saying that this whole profession of shepherds was taken up by people who are guilty of Gezel, and therefore the Chazaka changes in the other direction. Now we're going to assume that you are guilty as charged. Others say that this is not Gezel d'oraisa. Why is this not Gezel d'oraisa? You took your sheep into the other person's field. Anybody? We always quote a pasuk here, I'm going to quote it again and again, that Gezel d'oraisa is called Vayikach esachanis miyad ha-mitzri, meaning you put your hand into his pocket and you take something out of his pocket. Here, what are you doing? Are you actually pulling the wheat out of the ground or the whatever he's eating?
You're not doing it. The animal's doing it.
Correct, the animal is doing it. You're just a gorem. You're just setting it up so that the animal will eat. And that's not gezel d'oraisa. That's called gram gzela. So, for example, we said yesterday, for those who remember, that for Gzela, under certain circumstances, you'll be Chayiv Malkus, even though it's a Lamanita Klase, but let's say Bitlo Velo Bitlo. I'm not going to go through it today again. In the case of someone who brings his animal to someone else's field and he lets the animal eat on its own, although he's a no good scoundrel, and basically he's a Goslin in our terms, but technically he's only a Goreng Gzela. He would not be Chayiv Malkus under any circumstances because he has not violated Gzela B'yadayim in a direct way. It's only an indirect Gzela, and that would not constitute a psul d'orais. There would be no malchus in any event for this kind of a shepherd to doing what he does.
So if the Rabban was attacking it, then if they had Adam that he put his, he let his sheep go on somebody else's property, so would they get malchus to Rabban based on that if they had?
I don't know. I think your question will be relevant later when we speak about Gezel Mishum Darkei Shalom. Here, it seems that the Rabbanon are creating a psul edus. What they're saying is that he's not credible, meaning we don't believe him when he testifies. But I can't tell you that the Rabbanon created a new gether of Gzela. He's still called Grama, and he's Gorim. By the way, if you ask me, would it be chayv to pay and compensate the owner of the field, the answer is a definite yes. Okay. But not midin gzela. But that's midin what's called esh. You know, there are four olas nezikin at the beginning of a sect above a comma. One of them is called esh. Esh means when I set up something that has its own power to damage. Like, for example, if I put something on a very high ledge, and by virtue of gravity and so forth, wind, it's going to go down and destroy someone's field. So I'm chayev to pay him and compensate him midin esh. Are you familiar with that? That's called avnu v'sakinu masos shenicha barosh gagma. Also, the Gemara in the sixth parak of Masecht Bava Kamma, in Parak HaKodesh, says that if you take an animal, even if it's not your animal, and you put it on top of someone's kama kuf mem hey means his stalks of wheat or whatever, and it eats the wheat, you have to pay midin esh. Why? Because now the animal's power to eat is sort of like the power of the wind to carry something high down through gravity and make it damage. So it's really interesting because although the shepherd would be chayv to compensate the owner of the field, but it wouldn't be midin gzela. And how much more so if it's not his animal? Again, let's leave out the riff for a moment. Before the riff came along, we assumed that even if he's shepherding someone else's animal, he becomes posel. Well, that couldn't be gzela in any event. If he would have to compensate, it wouldn't be because he gained something. It's not because of his revach, but rather because of the act of esh, of burning, of lighting a fire. Anyway, that's a little bit of an excursion into Bava Kamma. Now we get to Gaboyim and Mochsim. And again, we want to find out at what point in time did the Rabbanon extend the Psul Edus to these categories. And then we can get back to Roim a second time in Rava. That's the part of the sugi that I find extremely complicated and challenging. So I'm kind of stalling for time. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. So what's Gaboyim and Mochsim? May Ikara Sofur, at the beginning, when it was, let's say, the time of the Mishnah, for example, the Mishnah doesn't mention Gaboyim and Mochsim as being included under the enumerated list of Psuliedus, the Mai the Kayetz Lehu Kashakli, that the king himself would set the rates for taxing, how much tax exactly each person in the city would have to pay, and they would collect, you know, faithfully and loyally that amount of tax and not go beyond, and whatever collections of taxes that they implemented, they would then turn that money over to the king. You know, the king said, this is the rate of taxes, this is what you have to bring home to the king, to the treasury, and that's the way they did it. So there's no reason why we should accuse Gaboyim or Mochsim of any sort of gzela. But came on the Chazi to Kashakli Yisera. Now the tax collectors started taking advantage of the situation. Nobody would know exactly what the king had authorized them to collect. So Shakli, they would take Yisera, a little bit extra money. You follow? Again, they couldn't double it because then people would probably sue him you know, in a court of law, and he would really get thrown into jail. But you know what? He would, you know, instead of, he would sort of cut corners, I guess you'd say, he would add a little bit of a percentage. You know, that's for me. I'm going to give 95% to the king, but 5% or 2% I'm going to pocket for myself. And that's Gzela, and therefore the Apostle Yedus. Once again, Rabosai, what question should we ask? The old question.
This
should be Gzela Doraisa. Why does this come under Hosifu Alem? So once again, we're going to give the same answers that we gave earlier. At least one of the two answers. Number one, the Torah assumes that every person has a cheskes kashrus. He's innocent until proven guilty. And although this became rampant behavior amongst the Gabbai and the Moksim, but nevertheless, you can't prove, we don't have two witnesses to testify that this particular Mokhes Joe, or Gabbai Joe, has actually overcharged people and he's pocketing the money for himself. So what the Rabbanu are doing, they're changing the chazok, and they're saying instead of having a cheskes kashrus, you have a cheskes gazlonus. But there's a shita here of Rabbeinu Chananel. Now if anybody wouldn't mind taking a look at Rabbeinu Chananel, if you have it on the page, it's all the way on the bottom. And it starts with the word Ve'hagaboy. Do you see that? Again, the print is quite small, but see if you can find it. And basically, Rabbeinu Chananel has the following opinion. He says that mochzin would not be possible because they pocketed money beyond that which was set as the price of taxes. Because if that would be the case, if that's what the issue is with mochzin, then we're back to Gaboyim. Because Gaboyim are the ones, as we saw in the Gemara, who take a little bit more than they're supposed to be taking. So what's mochzin? And this is the old problem that we've had. What's the difference between this kind of tax collector and that kind of tax collector? Call him a gabai, call him a mochzin. What difference it makes? But rather, says Rabbeinu Chananel, the reason why we passel the mochzin is because, listen carefully, lo hayu mechalkim es hakitzvah lefi mamonu shel kol echad elehelu lazeh upichsu lazeh. It means that they played favorites. Probably people bribed them. Instead of dividing the kitzvah, in other words, let's say, for example, the population was 1,000 in that city. The government expected, let's say, one gilder, you know, per person. So he would have to collect 1,000 gilder. How would that gilder be collected? It all depended upon the financial status of each person. So if a person was making 100, he would pay, let's say, 1% of a gilden. But if he was only making 10, and that was his income, he would pay a much smaller percentage. But they decided who would pay more and who would pay less. That's what the Moches did. That really comes very close to outright gzela. And although it's one notch lower than the gzela of a gabite stalker, because the gaboim would take more money collected and pocket it for themselves. And that's not something that the mochzin would do. But nevertheless, the mochzin was stealing from so-and-so in order to give money to so-and-so. Do you follow? It's like, you remember Robin Hood? You know, it's kind of like a Robin Hood philosophy. The Nebuki Yosef says that Natlu me'aniyim v'lo me'ashirim. They were paid off, these mochzin, by the rich people, so that they couldn't collect from the rich people, because they pocketed the money they got as gifts from the rich people. They would collect the entire tax, let's say the 1,000 gilden for the city, from the poor people. And that's also gzela. So there's bribery and gzela. And then the Nebuki Yosef goes a step further and he says, Hayuchotvim v'lokhim es amas shalomidas bailim, that sometimes the owner who was meant to be taxed, right, the rank and file citizen, would refuse to pay his taxes, or maybe he would hide from the governmental tax collectors. The tax collectors would go into his property and they would confiscate that which they needed for the tax collection. So yesh lahakshos. Let's take the case of the Gabbai. Again, in the case of the Moches, it's a little bit more complicated. He's charging this one and not this one. He's playing favorites. Maybe he's taking bribes, but it's not clear that he's pocketing anything. But certainly in the case of Gabayim, the Gemara says explicitly, the Kashakli Yisera, that they take the extra amount above and beyond what the taxes are, and they pocket that money. Madua Einam Nifsolim Midoraisa Kigazlan. And this is the question that we've been addressing over and over again. Let's see. He has here two answers, one from the Muki Yosef and one the Kesef Mishnah in the Rambam. The Muki Yosef says that Kevan Shehem Notlim Es Hamas Avur HaMelech V'lo Me'atzmon L'chein Ein Nifsolim. I don't know what he means by that. But let's see, the Rambam is a little bit easier. He says, Lachu Es HaTosef Es Li'atzmon, says the Kesef Mishnah, so the Rambam says that they're posel doraisa. So if you'll bear with me for just one moment, in the back of the Masifta we have something called the Yalkut Habiurim. What Amud are we on? Chaf Heyamid Beis. Okay, just let me read to you something here in the Yalkut Habiurim. On Daf Chaf Hei Amid Beis, he says the following. First of all, he says that Bir Hachiluk Bein Roel Legabai. Okay, so the every single Roel is assumed to be possible. And we're not sure what the status of a Stam Gabai is. Okay, that we'll get to a little bit later on. But he writes, HaRambam Chilek Bein Gabai LeMoches, SheMoches is Stam Psulim, so that Moches has the same din as a Roeh. We assume a Roeh is Posel, and we assume a Moches is Posel. In Gabai, he says, who's pocketing the money, we would have to have testimony of two kosher edim in a court of law to prove that this particular Gabai is actually pocketing the money. Now, according to the Rambam, that Moches is posel b'stam, even though we don't know for sure that he's pocketing any money, but Gabai is pocketing the money. He says, "Yesh omrim shamoches gover meches lefi umdun dato." So the Moches is collecting the tax based on his evaluation. But ein adomer bekitzva. But it's not absolutely clear, and we indicated this before, exactly how much the tax should be. Lefichach bestam apostle. In other words, if we don't know any evidence to the contrary, that a moches is assumed to be possible, because we assume that they collect in an illegal way. In other words, they put the burden of the monies on certain people, certain members of the community, and alleviate others. So that's the Rambah in Choshen Mishpat. However, the Darkei Moshe, which is the same author, but in his commentary on the Tur, he writes that the difference between a Gabai and a Moches is that a Gabai collects Mashi Yesh Lo Kitzva, Va Moches Gover Lefi Omed Adas. I'm not sure exactly if, let's see. He says, Koser Rabbeinu Chananel, because otherwise that would be a repeat performance of Gabayim. Ela Hamalchus Matila Mas Al Kol Yehudim Al Kol Echad VeEchad Lefi Mamono. So the tax is relative to your financial status. V'Tafkid Hamochsin LaHarich Kol Echad, and the Moches is commissioned to evaluate how much money does each person have, and if how much of a percentage he has to give his taxes. Vehem nosim ponim, right? They give a tax break l'miktsason u'machbidim al acherim yosim in aroy. That's the shita of Rabbeinu Chananel, and that's called mochsin, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But gaboyim, we said, were people who actually pocketed the money themselves. So why aren't gaboyim posel doraisa? Isn't this gezel? He says, "V'ein lomer shebe'emes osam shalokhim yosef psulim midoraisa." El Shabbanon osifu pasulis kulam. This was our answer, that the Rabbanon said that even if we don't know about this particular gabai, that he's actually pocketing money, taking more than the taxes, but nevertheless, he's guilty until proven innocent. He rejects that pshat. Why? Because the Gemara is going to say later on that we need testimony against the gabai to establish that he's actually pocketing money. But if we have testimony and we've proved with all the evidence and clarity that this gabai is pocketing money, so then why isn't that a psul doraisa? Once we have testimony and evidence to prove that these gaboyim have pocketed the money, psulim midoraisa. So where did the rabbanon come into play over here? Why do we need it? Some sort of enactment to rabbanon? Ella shrabbanon hosifu shafilim achakach ziru. Even if later on they will return the money, mikolokom heim psulim, they still remain posel. Now, why would they be posel after they return the money? So the answer is because they don't really return the money to everyone. They don't remember who they took money from. And therefore, at the end of the day, the Rabbanan say this is not a real tshuva, because they can't return and guarantee that anyone they stole from got the money back. There's such a massive amount of people. Then he offers another answer. Mikeivan shadayin omdim b'tafkidam b'gabos ubimechas harim chashudim lachzor l'kilkulam. They didn't resign, they continue in their capacity, and they get the salary as a gabai. That's not called chazor. Do you remember Rabbi said that we said that chazor always requires that you go to the other extreme and you completely cut yourself off from that profession, from that activity? Now, there's an interesting comment here in the name of the Or Zeruah, one of the Chachmei Ashkenaz and the Rishonim. He says that even if you don't know from whom you stole, and the gabai has taken money from untold, anonymous people, faceless people, he can still do tshuva, and he can be machzir. How can he be machzir if he doesn't know whom to give to? Al yedei sheyaseh tzorchei rabin, which means like he builds bridges, and everybody benefits from it. Now we get back to the Ruki Yosef, which we saw before. Shemedubar she'et yoter she'notlu einam lokhim li'atzmam. Even though they overcharge people for taxes, they don't pocket it, because that would be gezel gomur, and then it would be posel d'oraisa. Elamah she'notlu yoser, mishum she'choshishim, she'af she'einam tzrichu l'zeh achshav, mikol mekom shemi yitztarchu l'zeh li'achar zman. In other words, the moches, well, let's call it the gabai, is always in charge. He's going to be held personally responsible if he doesn't produce a certain sum of money for the king. So he always takes a little extra and he puts it on the side for a rainy day, right? Just in case he won't have enough money and he couldn't collect people, flew the coop and he wasn't able to find them and tax them. But Eino Notil Sehefrish Liatzman, he doesn't take it and put it into his own bank account. Elameiniach Oso Lepam HaBo'ah. But rather, he puts it away for the future. V'yachol pichein paslu rabbanim mishum shenotlu yosef mimashal yitzarch ka'es. Since right now they're taking more than what they need for this moment in time, therefore the rabbanim said they're paslu. So again, we have a number of different approaches here to answer the question: why is it that a gabai who is accused of pocketing money when he collects his taxes, why isn't he posel d'oraisa? Why do we need a rabbinic psul? One approach is to say that until the Rabbanan came along, we didn't know for sure that he was pocketing the money, and you're innocent until proven guilty. The Rabbanan changed that. Another approach is to say that they weren't considered possible until we had evidence that they in fact pocketed the money. And if you'll ask if they pocketed the money, that should be a psul d'oraisa. The answer is that they returned the money that they stole, but the Rabbanan felt that that's not enough because they maintained their status as gabbayim. They didn't give up their job, and that's not considered chazara. Others say that the reason why the Rabbanan pasul them even though they return the money is because it's impossible for them to do an adequate job and return the money to all the people they stole from, because they were stealing from untold numbers of people. And finally, the last answer that we had was that these gabbayim never actually pocket their money. What they do is they take extra money and collect it and they put it away for a rainy day. You know, like a, what do they use that phrase? The eggs in a hat. What?
A contingency fund.
A contingency fund, yeah. Omar Rava. Now we get back to Roa. Roa Sha'amru. Echad Roa Behema Daka. The Echad Roa Behema Gasa. The two categories of animals that require a shepherd. One is what we call Keves V'as. Those are sheep and goats, otherwise known as Tzon. Otherwise known in the Gemara's language as Behema Daka. These are smaller, more sensitive animals. And the other category of animals are called Behema Gasa, like for example an ox. And Rava says both of them are disqualified. In both cases, the assumption of the Rabbanan is that they trespass with their animals into other people's grazing land, and therefore they steal. Now, what's the big deal over here? Why do I need Rava to equate Behema Daka with Behema Gasa? So we'll see that in fact Rava himself seems to distinguish between these two categories of animals. Umi Amar Rava Hachi, is this really what Rava held? And we can equate Behema Gasa with Behema Daka, and even in the case of Behema Gasa, these big animals which are called Bakar, like for example an ox. The shepherd of an ox is considered pasul. Again, according to the Rif, it means he's shepherding his own ox, if you recall. V'amar Rava, Rava said no. Roa behema daka, be'eretz Yisrael psulim, be'chutz la'aretz ksherim. V'roa behema gasa, afil be'eretz Yisrael ksherim. Now, for some reason, the halacha of a roa is more strict in Eretz Yisrael, but even so, that's only with regard to Behema Daka, says Rava. In other words, we don't assume that he's stealing in order to feed a Behema Gasa like a shar. We assume in the smaller animals, he takes them into the grazing area of other people, trespassing and stealing. Now, why are we more machmir in Eretz Yisrael? Hatam, says Rashi, because Eretz Yisrael, we have to be machpid not to raise animals because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Okay, this is Sugyan Baba Basra about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Let's go with the Yad Ramah. The Yad Ramah says that Gam Bechutzor, it's a Mivoda, Shem Meshalchem, Beimoso, Bekavoda, Besoda, Shalchem, Erem, Nifsolim. But in Eretz Yisrael, because the Torah is very machpid about how we live our lives in Eretz Yisrael, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael means to observe the Torah in Eretz Yisrael, they upped the ante and they were more careful, and they instituted as many enactments and gzeiros as they could to force people to live up to the standards, the moral standards of the Torah in Eretz Yisrael. You hear this, Rabosai? It's very important. We have to be more careful in Eretz Yisrael than in Chutz La'aretz. That doesn't mean we have to be lax in Chutz La'aretz, but we have to set up higher standards and demands of behavior in Eretz Yisrael. So Rava says this whole entity called a Psul Edus, which was a rabbinic enactment with regard to Roim, was only instituted in Eretz Yisrael, and only in which kind of animals? Behema Daka, only in the smaller animals, like the sheep and the goats. Bechutz La'aretz, there was never a Psul of Roa, not even for Behema Daka. And if we have evidence that a roa behemadaka took his animals into someone else's field in chutzlar, it's enochinami be posuliyedus, but we don't have this highest standard to automatically and absolutely disqualify a roa in chutzlar. Now, what about in Eretz Yisrael? So Rava said in Eretz Yisrael, which kind of an animal, if it's shepherded by a roa, the roa becomes posel? Only what? Help me out here. Only a behema daka, but roa behema gasa, if he's shepherding a larger animal like an ox, is afilu beretz Yisrael ksherim. Even Eretz Yisrael is kosher. Now, we don't understand exactly why. Let's assume for the time being that in the case of an ox, you know, how much does he gain, you know, by feeding the ox a couple of blades of grass that he stole from grazing in someone else's land? You know, an ox needs a much more serious kind of diet. Is that so? I mean, how much do you feed on an average day an ox? I don't know. I remember when I was in the Rockies in Canada, they told me that a grizzly bear eats 250,000 bushels of berries in a day. I could never understand that number, but anyway, that's what she told us. So I don't know what you feed an ox, but probably, you know, an ox is a pretty, you know, has a pretty hefty diet. You know, he's not a vegan or anything like that. So the Gemara answers, Hahu, that which Rava said that it's okay in the case of a shepherd of a behemah gasa, and he's kosher liedus, that doesn't refer to the roim who take the animals outside of the urban areas out into the fields. In that case, if the shepherd is out in the fields, in the open areas, then Rava would not distinguish between behema daka behema gasa, even a roa behema gasa out in the fields would be posuliyedus. And I'm not sure, but this seems to contradict what I said before, that in the case of an ox, you really need a more serious diet. The Gemara is saying, no, there's some difference between the urban areas, which is called the yishuv, and the outlying areas, which are the sados, the megadlim itmar. So that when Rava said that a roa of a behema gasa is kosher, even in Eretz Yisrael, he was talking about megadlim. Megadlim means that these are animals that are domesticated, and he's able to raise even a bull, right, an ox or a bull, in his own backyard. And since he's able to watch them and guard them, that they shouldn't run away, we're not afraid that he'll graze them in other people's fields. In the case of behema daka, it's very easy for these animals to, you know, let's say, dig their way under the fence or jump over a fence, and they run away, and they end up in other people's fields, and therefore, Rava says that psulim in Eretz Yisrael. Hakadami mistabra. The Gemara wants to bring a diuk in a Mishnah that we learned to support this approach. Minaktani, it says in the Mishnah on Chav Dalet, that if a man says to his other litigant, Ne'amonim alai shlosha roi bakar, that I will agree and consent to accept the decision of three shepherds, and the Gemara, the Mishnah itself vacillates, the Machlokas Tanoim, can he change his mind, and so forth and so on. So the Gemara thinks right now, my lovely Eidus, that when it says Neman Alai, we accept these three Roi Bakar, it means we accept them as witnesses. And if had they, as we said before, had they not accepted them as witnesses, apparently they would have remained disqualified. Now, bakar means what kind of an animal? A small goat or a sheep? No. Now, that's called what? Son. Bakar refers to the heavier animals. You may know that that the Torah always differentiates between son and bakar in many different contexts. You know, today, if you're into diets and so forth, they differentiate between bakar and son. You know, that son is a little bit easier on the system than bakar is. Well, what's bakar called in English? You know, the heavier animals. What are they called?
Cattle.
What?
Cattle.
Yeah, but in dietary terms, they... I forgot what it's called. You know. Anyway.
Cholesterol.
Yeah, maybe cholesterol. Maybe that's what it is.
Meat.
Yeah, heavy meat, right.
So they need to make a distinction between the Hemadaka and the Asla. Hemadaka, they actually destroy the roots.
Machal Yakarino, you mean?
Yeah, they had destroyed the roots, whereas the Gasa only eats the grass on top.
Right. But I guess as far as Gzela is concerned, maybe even if you just take the grass on top, or quasi Gzela, we discussed whether that's Grav Gzela. So again, the Gemara assumes now that when it says Neman Alai Shlosha Roi Bakar, we're talking about Li Edus, and Bakar is on the list. And Bakar is a Bei Magasa. So we see clearly from the Mishnah that even in the case of Bei Magasa, there's a psul, which would mean that if you took the Bei Magasa out into the fields, then that kind of shepherd would be disqualified. And that would be a diuk which would support our interpretation of Rava, that in the case of a Bei Magasa, there is Enochinami of psulo. The Gemara says, no, that's not the subject of our Mishnah. Ledina, the Mishnah wants to know about the status of these Roei Bakar as a dayan, as a judge, and had the litigants not accepted upon themselves these Roei Bakar as judges, and these judges are ignorant, they would be disqualified for judgment. You can't prove anything about their status vis-a-vis Eidus and whether or not they would be disqualified. And Ali Gemara supports this interpretation that the subject of our Mishnah is Dayanus and not Eidus. Deka Nami, Bidektari Shlosha Roi Bakar, Ve'ili Eidus Shlosha Lomali. If we're talking about testimony, we never heard of any significance to number three in testimony. In judgment, we need a court that's comprised of three judges. And if these three judges are Roi Bakar, then they're ignorant of the law. They therefore are certainly disqualified to judge unless it was Neman Alai and the two Bali Dinim accepted them. So Gemara says, I'm not happy with this. Why? Elamai Ladina, so the subject of our Mishnah is the status of these three Roi Bakar as judges? My ear is Shlosha Roi Bakar. Why did the Mishnah have to say Shlosha? Kol Beit Losa de Logamri Dina Nami. In other words, any one of the three judges who is ignorant of the law, that would be enough to passel the Bezdin. You need a Bezdin that's made up of three judges, all of whom are kosher. So why did the Mishnah have to emphasize that we were talking about Shlosha Roi Bakar? Forget about that. It could have simply mentioned that there was one Roi Bakar and we still need the agreement of the two litigants. So that the Gemara is not bothered by. Why? Hachi Kamar. This is what the Tana wanted to be Machadish. Afilu Hani. Even in the case of Roi Bakar, Delo Shchiche B'Yishuv, we don't find too many Roi Bakar. And if we do find Roi Bakar that are available here in town and they could possibly be accepted as judges, they never heard anything about judgment, they don't know. These are people who really belong out in the fields. They're not part of the, you know, interaction with people in the urban centers themselves, and therefore they are really way out as far as judgment is concerned, as far as knowledge is concerned. And the Chiddush is that Roei Bakar are so ignorant that you would think that even if they accepted, meaning the two litigants agreed with each other to accept these Roei Bakar, that these Roei Bakar are such ignoramuses, so to speak, they're so ignorant of the law to such an extent, to such an extreme, that they shouldn't, you know, the acceptance of these judges upon themselves is a very tenuous kind of enterprise. However, take a look at Rashi, Dibra Maschil Delo. which is towards the bottom of your page. Rashi says on the second of the wide lines, "Delo shchicha biyishuv, velo ro, velo shamu, iske din beinon lechavero, I kablininu alayhu lo matzi lemeheder." Rashi adds six words here at the end, that the Havamina, which the Mishnah is coming lafuke to exclude, is that we would have thought that if they accepted upon themselves these two litigants, Roe Bakar, who was so far removed from judgment, then it was an absolute commitment on their part. This is what we call, if you remember the Gemara's language, Toli Bidas Acherim. Toli Bidas Acherim means that it's totally dependent upon others. And this is not an Asmachta, meaning an Asmachta is when you think, that's Rashi Shida, when you anticipate that you'll win the case and you will gain, and instead you lost. So that wasn't a real full-fledged agreement. But in the case of Roy Bakar, that is so ignorant, what are the chances that they will judge in your favor? I mean, you have no way of knowing such a thing. Now, we don't have much time, but just for one more minute, let's read the introduction to the next part of this Gemara. Remember, we said before that in the case of a Gabbai, he is accused or suspected of pocketing money that he collected as so-called taxes. But we don't really know that the Gabbai actually did so. In the case of a Roeh, it was a part of the trade, so to speak. You know, this was almost written into the job description of being a Roeh, is that you would be careless about your animals. Let them roam and perhaps enter into the fields of others. So that's what Rabbi Yehuda says, that Stam Roeh, that even if we don't have evidence to prove and establish that this Roeh allowed his animals to go into the Edom's fields, possibly, he's still considered possibly Edus. But Stam Gabbai, in a case of a Gabbai, how do we know that he's pocketing? Well, if we don't know it based on evidence, then he's kosher. He's kosher liyedus. So Mirtz Hashem, tomorrow we'll try to develop this a little bit further, and we'll speak a little bit more about the difference between a Roeh and a Gabbai. Okay then? So that's what we have for